Coming up on Digital Music Trends 194, recorded on the 30th of July 2014, a special show focused on independent musicians as we chat about Bandcamp, fan interaction, Spotify, YouTube, copyright review, and a lot more. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Leonelli and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And if you'd like to receive a weekly newsletter on the latest shows that are coming out, please sign up on bit.ly/DMTlist. And this week it's a real pleasure to welcome three great guests, starting with Zoe Keating. If you don't know her, she's a wonderful artist producing music with her cello. It's mostly solo cello music, which is amazing. And it's really great to have you here today, Zoe. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And it's also a real pleasure to welcome Steve Lawson, another great independent artist who is a solo bass guitarist. So it's a solo musicians today. It's pretty great.
Hello.
Hey, nice, how's it going? And you're in Birmingham, you right?
Yes.
Great. Sorry. Awesome. And Zoe's in San Francisco, so we're spread out today. It's all pretty sort of spread across time zones. And last but not least, it's great to welcome Glenn Peoples from Billboard back on the show. If you don't read his pieces on Billboard, you should. So go and check him out on billboard.com. And hi, Glenn. Thanks for joining me.
Hi. Thanks for having me again.
Awesome. So today it's going to be a bit of a different show than usual. I guess it's a sort of a summer. We don't have as many news to talk about, but it's actually quite great because we get to talk about a few different things actually than what we usually cover on the show. And we're going to use some of the stories that came up this week as sort of a way to leapfrog and then talk about different issues that are involving independent artists as well. So I wanted to start by talking about a commentary piece that was posted on Digital Music News that considers the role of platforms like Bandcamp, Patreon, and Pledge, and how they are changing the way independent artists can monetize their music. The article says, "Can this company save streaming and the music industry?" So, Bandcamp, for example, has paid out over $76 million to artists and continues to pay out nearly $3 million a month. They've tripled where they were 24 months ago. 50,000 unique artists sell something every month, and so a great success story there. And so, the article basically points Bandcamp, portrays Bandcamp, Patreon, and Pledge as potential saviors of the music industry, especially for independents. Glenn, so starting with your perspective, sort of as an independent observer, what do you make of the growth of these platforms in the last 2 years, and how do you see them perhaps disrupt the mainstream narrative, which is that people are moving away from downloads and moving to streaming, and there's no two ways about it? But these platforms actually seem to be changing how the narrative is shaping up on that front.
Well, these platforms show that people still buy things, if that's what you're getting at. if I remember the Digital Music News guest post correctly, this person was encouraging Bandcamp to create a streaming service.
Right.
And I found that really weird. I think Bandcamp is so successful because it does one thing and it does it really well.
Yeah.
And that's an old adage in business. Don't lose focus. Just focus on one thing, do it really well, and then once maybe you do that really well, you can move on.
Yeah.
And I think Bandcamp is special in that it has a narrow focus. It doesn't want to be a digital distributor. It doesn't, my guess only right now, it doesn't want to be a streaming company. It doesn't want to be all things to all people. It wants to focus on one thing.
Yeah.
And I think Pledge Music, I think other companies will probably follow the same path.
Yeah,
at least I hope they do. I don't want companies losing focus before they get really good at what they set out to do.
Absolutely, and I didn't mention that part of the article because I wanted to focus, of course, on the download side of things and sales. But that was an interesting point. But I agree with you, Glenn, completely that I don't see these companies needing to do streaming right now. It just doesn't make sense. I wanted to ask you, turn the question to sort of Zoe and Steve. You use Bandcamp a lot to sell your music, and so I would imagine you try and direct as many people to Bandcamp as possible. So starting with Zoe, I guess, when did you start using Bandcamp, and how has that helped you along the way?
I started using Bandcamp for my last recording that I released, which was right when my son was born in 2010. And I was looking at the time for a way that I could, get my music as directly to my fans as possible, and that I could also, it was sort of easy to manage and various criteria. And it was Steve Lawson who told me about Bandcamp. I didn't know about it before. Mm-hmm. It was both Steve Lawson and I think my friend Amanda Palmer. They were both into it. Yeah. And so I immediately signed up. And let's put it this way. I put my album out and a couple weeks after my son was born, and I was able to set up the entire thing from bed, like while he was sleeping. Like wow. That's how easy it was to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, like sort of in between those like little in-between hours that you get as a new parent, that's how I released it. And it is sort of the primary way that my core fans, sort of the true fans, that's where they get my music first, is they go there. And I have my website kind of built around it. So it's very valuable. I like the way that it lets sort of my whales contribute more, and, you know, other people can contribute the minimum, or it sort of has that flexibility. And it's sort of, I feel like it's designed for an artist like me, where I have a core fan base that wants to support me as an artist.
Yeah.
So, and then kind of like they want the music second in some ways.
yeah, sure. Absolutely. Steve, on your front, did you use it longer than Zoe? Like as you might have actually turned around to it. And how did you come across it?
I think I came across it because it was set up that Ethan Diamond, who started Bandcamp and runs it, did it partially inspired by an ebook written by a colleague of mine, Andrew Dubber, who was on the show last week or a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. So I mean, Dubber's sort of ideas were very heavily involved in that, and Dubber and I have been friends and working together and trying to solve all the world's problems together for 5 or 6 years. And so I guess when he told me about it very early on, and so I signed up very early, and it fitted the way that I thought about things completely, because I wanted to be able to mess with pricing. I could see on iTunes that you know the big labels were constantly playing pricing games, and they'd reduce things to $3 for a week and see what would happen. But us as indies, we couldn't do that. We didn't know who was buying our stuff. We couldn't. It was all fixed price. You know, everything was $7.99 or $9.99 in the States.
Yeah.
And they decided whether or not long tracks were whatever. And you could only listen to at that point 30 seconds of it as a preview, which just seemed insane. So Bandcamp basically, it's almost like I'd given them a list that didn't exist and said, "Here you are. Can you fix all of these things?" And they went, "Yeah, sure. And here's a load of other cool stuff as well."
Yeah.
So it did a couple of things for me. One of which is that my last, I don't know, something like 11 releases, or no, maybe 15 releases, haven't because I lose track. I put an album out yesterday.
Nice. I just like that.
That was recorded on Saturday. Well, no, well, except you can't even buy it. You have to buy two other records in order to get it. It's just, I'll explain some of that later on. But it's meant that I release a lot more music. I'm very prolific. I'm an improviser, and so, you know, and a fairly good one. So lots of what I do, especially when I'm interacting with other musicians, that turns into stuff that's worth putting out there. But it's not the kind of thing that it's worth me building a campaign around. I don't want to have to spend money on marketing. I want to put it out there and get on to the next thing. And so I only need, you know, a very, very small number of interested people to make it viable. And viability for me is being able to release music in a way that doesn't stop me releasing more music.
Yeah, sure.
I just want to be able to, I want to keep making things. And so Bandcamp Bandcamp is pretty much the only place I can imagine being able to do that. So, yeah, it's a service that's built for that. I mean, I don't even bother putting things on iTunes or anything else anymore. I've recently signed up with a different aggregation partner, but I'm so picky. I mean, I took all my stuff off Spotify because why would I go on Spotify? I don't use it. I don't particularly agree with the way they do things. I don't shop on Amazon anymore, so I don't want to put my music on Amazon because I don't like the way they do things. If they start paying tax, I might. So I'm sort of hamstrung by my own ethics to the point where I go, well, great, well, I'll just put it all on Bandcamp and then it'll be fine.
It's very cool. Glenn, I wanted to sort of bring it back to the communications point. You know, a lot of these platforms actually do a really good job at enabling sort of a conversation between the artists and the fan base that is buying the music. And I guess that's really what's lacking from the likes of iTunes and also from Spotify to a degree. There's not much of a two-way communication going on there. So how important do you think that is to artists? You know, of course, you're based in Nashville, so lots of independent artists there, I'm sure you know, that have to deal with finding a way to really communicate with people that are buying their stuff.
Yeah, well, I think the artists here could speak to that better than I could. You know, as a consumer, I have always got the feeling that artists like Bandcamp because they identify with it. And like Steve says, there are other reasons you might not want to be on certain platforms if you just have disagreements with certain business practices or big business practices, because these are big companies that are selling you music. And if you look long enough, you'll find something to dislike, honestly.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I think Bandcamp
just has that better relationship with people, mm-hmm. and it feels like a place for independent music. It feels more like, you know, to use an antiquated example, it feels more like a record store, I think, in that you go there and you find music, and you find typically independent music.
One of the big things with Bandcamp in terms of that business model thing that Glenn's getting out there is that they don't make money unless we make lots more money.
Yeah.
And that as a setup, as a relationship between them and the artists, is fantastic. They can't sell access to our stuff and make a load of money without us making anything. With Spotify, this whole negotiated terms thing, it's like, well, however we negotiate the terms, they're still in control of it. It's still about them saying that's okay. Bandcamp have set it up so that in order for them to make their 10 or 15%, we have to make 85 or 90%. So, you know, whatever they do, everything they do is in our best interest, because in order for them to make money, we have to make loads of money.
Yeah.
And that's a really, really healthy position, healthy relationship for us to have, because they apply all of their intelligence to us doing okay out of music. And I like that a lot. I like that a lot.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
I think it shows that the Bandcamp is a very single purpose a business, where Apple and Amazon sell music ultimately for other means. But sure. Like Steve says, Bandcamp's in it just to sell music for artists, and that's it.
Yeah.
And I think that shows.
Yeah,
absolutely. Zoya, I wanted to ask you about the communication side of things, because, of course, you've had a massive life-changing event, I guess, in the last couple of months, mm-hmm. which is an awful thing that happened. And sort of that's really driven a huge amount of support from your fan base. And so, of course, you know, feel free to just go into as many much detail, as little detail as you want, because I know that it's a very personal thing. But as far as sort of how your fans have managed to sort of really help just morally on what's going on.
Well, obviously my husband was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer in May, and it was really out of the blue, non-smoker and stuff. And we had sort of an issue in the first couple of weeks where the insurance company initially refused to cover his hospital stay. And, you know, those of you who aren't in the States know that a hospital stay is it was like $80,000. I finally started getting some, you know, the original bills. So, and we have health insurance. And so I just sort of started talking about it on Twitter, and I put a post up, and within hours, really, just people started contributing to our cause and just donating and buying my albums. At first, I only had Bandcamp up there, so everybody's, you know, my last album has been out for years now, and my new one, I'm supposed to release it this summer, and I've sort of put everything on hold for now. But everybody's got it already, and it seemed like all my fans just went up to Bandcamp and they bought it again for, you know, however much they wanted. So Bandcamp was kind of like the donation intermediary. And then I set up sort of a donation account and people donated there. But I really was totally floored by the outpouring. I still am. And
it's amazing. And you use Tumblr actually a lot to communicate with fans, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I found, I have a blog, and so I just posted something on Tumblr. And actually, it had two things. One was that my audience was, you know, I had to talk to them about it because I tell them everything usually.
Yeah.
And one was that they could reach out, you know, and they could hear what's happening, and I could connect with them and all that. But then the other thing about the Tumblr blog was that the local news station saw the blog, and then they came over to our house and I asked my husband, he's normally in the background with my son, and I said, "Are you okay with looking bad on television?" And he was like, "Okay." So within 24 hours, actually, the insurance company called me personally and said, you know, "Oh, this is that was our standard form letter, and we're so sorry that you've had this experience, and don't worry." Long story short, it's just, it's sort of an example of how, you know, in today's world, I only exist successfully as an artist because of my audience.
Yeah.
And I have a direct connection with them, and it's something that I've nurtured, and they're important to me. And it's been going sometimes I think it's a one direction, a one way street, it feels, for many artists. But whenever I'm, I remember when my son was born, it was similar, but this is a different situation.
Yeah.
Knowing that they're there and then just being able to talk to them on Facebook and on Twitter and, you know, is such a huge comfort for me to know that I'm not really, I don't know, I'm not alone. So it's like, I don't think artists talk about that much. It's like, I need them for reasons more than them buying stuff. Just knowing that they're listening is somehow really comforting. So it's a really human connection. I think services like Bandcamp and what have you, they emphasize how we are all humans and we are looking for these human things.
That's absolutely true. And Steve, on your front, like, did you feel, you know, the same way that you really take from the relationship that you have with your fans from Bandcamp or other sources, and you can actually, you know, have this two-way street relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things, just talking about Bandcamp briefly before we go on to the thing, is that it plays so nicely with other platforms, because it's not China, because as Glenn says, it's not trying to do everything, it's doing one thing. And so it interfaces well with Twitter. So you can have this community on Twitter and say, and now if you want to go and buy or listen or share or talk about what I do, you can take the links from Bandcamp and it embeds well on Tumblr and all that kind of stuff. So Bandcamp becomes this sort of resource in the middle of it all, but it's not it's not trying to say, have the conversation here, you must talk about music here.
Yeah.
We need to build our own Twitter and our own Facebook within it, because that would kind of destroy it.
Yeah.
The relationship both with my listeners, I've got to the point now where I can't even use the word fans, because most of them are it just seems so weird, because it's like, well, I'm a fan of your interestingness.
It's my friends, right?
Yeah, and friends is kind of it.
Maybe
we're expanding the definition of it, but they play a role in my life that is not just, you know, I put out music and they send me money. There's encouragement, there's support, there's mm-hmm. friendship, there's access to news and perspective and all kinds of stuff. And so there are people who I've met because they started out listening to my music and have become incredibly important friends, but also peers.
Yeah.
I mean, the number of musicians that I've met and maintain a relationship with alongside all of that, because everything's mixed up. And we buy each other's music and we talk about each other's music, and some of them are people who I'm guessing don't really like my music, which is fine. I'm a bass player who plays on his own. It sounds more like a day than a job anyway.
I'd love to say something else about Bandcamp, you know, not to be a total advertisement for them, but just sort of comparing, we have all these different services, you know, of course, we're in a year of, I think, really the change that we've all been talking about for a long time is happening, I think, this year, and will be complete by the end of year, of that everybody, you know, streaming is the medium, and it's hugely convenient and what have you. And I think that, yes, for finding music, it's hugely convenient, but we still can never put aside this the importance of connecting the artist with their listeners.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of why I do direct my energies. I don't discourage other platforms, but I direct my energies towards ways to get people to listen that I can maintain a connection with them. So that if they listen to me via Bandcamp, then I have a way to find them and a way to reach them. Whereas that's sort of the issue, you know, as marvelous as Spotify is as a listening platform, and there's no way for me to reach those fans. And I don't get, I've talked about data in the past, but at least with iTunes, because I have a direct account with Apple, I can get at least randomized zip codes or postal codes of people who purchase on iTunes. But I don't get anything really from Spotify. They made that sort of thing to put out some data for artists in December, but I haven't really found it to be very useful. So it's still going to be the case that, you know, randomized zip codes are good too, but it's still having that email address. And the fact that I can offer music in exchange from email address is really important. So that's really, as we sort of complete this transition to streaming, services like Bandcamp and Patreon and what have you are going to become even more important for the artistic middle class, you know, which I believe in. I don't believe it has to be all big. We can have a whole bunch of sort of lesser artists who are just all sort of about that connection with the fans.
Two short, small observations about Bandcamp. One of which is that it is a streaming service. I mean, you know, that unless you block tracks, and I've got friends who do block it, so you can only listen to a couple of tracks on their album. But I have all my stuff available there to be streamed for free by anyone at any point, as many times as they want. I kind of like that because the uniqueness of music is that the more we listen to it, the more we fall in love with it. That doesn't happen with film. People don't watch a film 25 times.
There's no paywall at Bandcamp.
So for me, it's much, much more useful and much more profitable, apart from anything else, for me to have.
Claws.
I think you've suddenly gone all Michael Jackson on us there. Ow! but it's much more profitable for me to have people listen on Bandcamp and have next to it a pay button where they can buy things. So Ari's thing about Bandcamp needing to build a streaming platform is like, well, no, they've got one. I mean, the mobile interface is lovely. If you want to bookmark a bunch of albums, if you're broke, and one of the things that I really like about Bandcamp is that I can have audience members who are completely broke, and they don't have to scrabble around for pennies in order to pay for my stuff. They can listen to it, they can download it and pay what they want. And I so often get people who come back years later and go, you know what, I've downloaded everything of yours for free over the years, and now, and because I sell my entire back catalogue on a USB stick.
Yeah, when that first buy came the out, whole thing, yeah.
When that first came out, it's like 20-something, I've lost count, 20-something albums on a USB stick. And the number of people who bought it who said, well, I've downloaded all these for free and I now feel like I should pay for them.
Yeah.
You know, my career is not about what happens this year. It's not about me cashing in on a tune that is going to go huge. And I don't want to retire off the back of one song. But the idea that we should be worrying about that is absurd. I want to keep making music, and I want to keep making it for people who like it. And
absolutely.
So that having that longer term, that longer framework in the relationship, so that someone who started listening to me 10 years ago can finally get around to the point of going, you know what, I'll buy the whole lot.
Yeah, Glenn,
I like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Glenn, I wanted to bring you in to talk about David Byrne. So you had a Q&A that came onto Billboard last week, I think, with him, where he raises some interesting points. I mean, he's always been very outspoken about artist issues and different monetization models, and controversially so, because, of course, some people agree with him, some people don't. So sort of how did that conversation come about? I think it was an email Q&A, but sort of what were your main takeaways from that conversation that you thought stood out from the questions?
Well, the conversation came about because there's a lot going on in Washington, D.C. this year about music licensing and copyright. There's a big move to update copyright law, which comes about only once every 20 years at best. 30 or 35 now. It's been a 30. We're going on 40, I think. And there have been some hearings in the House Judiciary about music licensing, a lot of copyright related things, and a lot of testimony from stakeholders all across the board, people representing musicians. We've had musicians and singer-songwriters and radio and anybody from streaming. Well, there was, yes, Pandora was represented, labels, publishers anyway. So the Copyright Office is also doing a review of music licensing and solicited comments. And I've gone through a lot of those comments just to see where different organizations stand on different issues. And that was really one of the reasons I reached out to David, because now I get to see how everybody would, if they had their way, would like to change copyright law to benefit them. And so I wanted, you know, his point of view on it. He's outspoken. He's usually pretty eloquent about copyright and music licensing. And you know, I thought it was a good short Q&A, which I think is available at Billboard, and he put it on his blog as well.
Yeah, sure. I mean, one of the things that sort of piqued my interest in what he said, you know, philosophically, I think the issue is, do we always do what is best for the consumer in the short run, or do we think more long-term about our culture and quality of life? Is a giant corporation that underprices everyone else and therefore seduces the consumer by the boatload necessarily the best for our future, and not just for the future of creative, but of all of us? And so that's sort of an interesting question as we look at companies like Pandora, that, of course, you know, we're looking at one of the news of this week is that, you know, the Q2 of Pandora, they're still losing money. They lost over $11 million, even though analysts were hoping they would finally turn around and start becoming a profitable company.
Yeah. You know, I think David's voice is important to have out there, and Congress has heard, you know, the artist voice, but you know, he brings points out there that people need to consider, because usually you get a lot of the business side and how companies need to make a profit and how companies need investment. And it's just a good point of view to have, and he asks good questions. Is this ultimately good for art and the artist? And I don't think enough people can ask that question. It's so important.
Yeah, yeah. Zoe, actually, you had a really interesting post back in December about Spotify, actually, and streaming and how those services affect the income of the, you know, middle class musician or you know the musician that is independent and relies on making money from the recorded music. So, have your thoughts evolved over the last few months at all? You know, of course, you're not negative about Spotify, but you do have some concerns around how much you can monetize that.
I mean, I tried to sort of raise these questions as a token independent artist, and yeah. I feel like personally, I haven't actually seen any decline from streaming, but I'm sort of a unique artist in that I existed perhaps before that, but I don't know. But my point about it is just allowing artists to have control over the connection with their audience.
Yeah.
And also in, I really liked the way that the, maybe this is sort of a key to my success, is that my career has followed the trajectory of the internet. Yeah. And so, it was a wonderful kind of Wild West for a long time. And now we have a consolidation among these companies, like just like we did in, it's like almost like the Ma Bell days. Yeah. It seems like we're just going to sort of consolidate until we have maybe Google who has Spotify and Apple who has Beats. And, you know, it's sort of the consolidation worries me because we go back to a power model. And I think the controversy over the YouTube music service kind of reveals this, where what I liked about the internet in the early days of the last, you know, in the last beginning part of the decade was that there were the little person, the little man could have the same deal as a large company for the most part. And we always, people who did file sharing and what have you, they railed against the music industry as being executives who kept the money from the actual artists. And so I feel like we're sort of moving into an ironic era where now the tech company is like the executive of the music industry, where, and going back to that contract, where I don't have any ability to negotiate the terms of that.
Yeah.
And however, if I was a large media company, I would be able to negotiate those terms. And so I think that I just am always interested in how can the individual find success in this market. And I've sort of found my own way around the music industry where I was rejected initially, and thanks to the internet. And so now perhaps the way that I did it isn't possible for other artists. So that's kind of what I'm trying to talk about. It's not like, is this royalty this big or that big? It's more like, what power does the individual have in going into the future? And I'm sort of more focused on that than the actual amount.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
No, absolutely. It does, actually. And that kind of raises a point for me on the value of association. So Glenn, sorry, did you have any... did you know anything about this Content Creators Coalition that David Byrne mentioned? I haven't managed to look into it very much, but did you know what it's all about?
Well, I know a little bit about it. I know there are a lot of artists behind, a lot of different types of creators, and I believe there are some authors involved, and I wouldn't be surprised if there are visual artists as well.
Right.
And they really want to do what Zoe's talking about, is giving a collective voice, and that collective, ultimately, I think, collective negotiating power and to independent artists, to artists of all kinds, because you know, the smaller the seller,
yeah,
the more difficult it is to go up against a really big buyer, and and it's one of the few examples of artists getting together and banding around in this type of issue.
Yeah,
I think we've seen a little bit of it in the UK. But in the U.S., until now, I don't think there's been something really cohesive like this.
Mm-hmm.
That's what
I wanted to say about the Content Creators Coalition. I was at the early meetings for that, and then I dropped out for various personal reasons that I've had. And it is very hard to organize artists around a topic and to find out what their goal is. And there are many artists who are against technology in general. And then you have people on the other end of the spectrum like me, where we need these services to survive, but I don't feel like it should be money going to tech or money going to artists. Like, why can't we like share it a little bit more? I know that there's a lot of really good people in that group, and they're trying to find, I think, a common message for all of them, which I think is an admirable goal, and I'm I'm very curious to see how it turns out. Yeah. But I'm always wary about like pitting the sides against each other. And I realize even I can do that by talking. And so I've been trying to back off a little bit and just say like, well, what are the core issues we're talking about here? I don't know.
It's super interesting. And Steve, like, what is your take on collective organizations of this kind? You know, of course, we've been talking a lot about WIN, the Worldwide Independent Network, but that seems to be really label focused for independent labels. But as far as independent artists, as I was saying, there's a Featured Artist Coalition here in the UK. There's this new body that we just talked about. But you know, do you feel the need to be part of something like that?
Well, no, not normally. I mean, I like the idea of them. I think that the problem is that the model they tend to follow is the lobby group idea, that they have a manifesto and they will push that and they will go for that agenda.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is that they become slightly myopic and that their role becomes to defend a position rather than to explore things in a much more useful way. And so the people I tend to gravitate towards in these kind of discussions are academics. Because if they're not, as long as they're not sponsored by somebody or other, that actually academics tend to be the ones who look at this from a much broader perspective and do the research. And so my favorite of them in terms of looking at what's good for artists and audiences is an amazing woman called Nancy Baim,
who
Zoe's met as well. And the stuff that she's doing on artist audience relationships and how we feel about it, not just what's good for money and what's good for this and that, but how it makes artists feel to expose themselves in a new way to their audiences by having to talk to them, and how some of us, I thrive on it, but there are other artists who find it difficult. And I think bringing those kind of voices and that sort of research mentality into it is much more useful, because there are whole bits of this conversation that get missed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for example, that none of the artist lobby groups are comfortable with the idea that it's possible that music has just become less important to people. That because we as musicians, it's our lives. But actually, I mean, I don't know if it's still the case, but for a very long time after people were saying, isn't it terrible that file sharing is cannibalizing music sales, actually sales of physical entertainment media were going up. It's just that music was less important to people. That games and DVD box sets looked like much, much better proposition as a sort of value commodity. So people would go out and buy a house box set and get 1,000 hours of Hugh Laurie's terrible American accent. And that, but what nobody was talking about was that was a 70-song compilation album as well, and it was all licensed and paid for. And it was, for the most part, brand new music. They weren't licensing Don't Stop Believing Again.
Yeah.
They were paying for new artists to kind of stick it on there. So the majors weren't that interested in that, because for them, most of their money is in the back catalogue. Is in the value of stuff that people already, because getting people to hear new music is really expensive. It always has been and it always will be.
Yeah.
Whether it's me doing it on my own or whether it's Warner's. Warner's going to make way more money out of the 100,000 songs that they own the rights to and that are already paid off, that they can license to other people for nothing just because people already want to hear them because they know them.
Yeah.
And they run out of trying to launch new artists.
Going back to I would say, music. Music is still important, but we're also all really, really busy.
Yeah.
And nearly all the conversations I have about music with my friends who are not professional musicians are all about, like, oh, which service should I choose? Because there's no way that I have time to, like, nobody rips CDs anymore. Like, it takes too much time. Like, I wouldn't. Like in the past, it's like you'd get your CDs and you'd know every time you'd get one, you'd like put it in your computer, you'd download, and you'd have like some central music collection. Even that is like way too hard now.
Yeah.
We have, the shared drive in our house, and I find that I don't use it anymore either, the shared drive full of music. I end up just going online to find it. So that's not necessarily about music. It's like this, there's just this erosion in time and, and stuff. And so something like Spotify or, just use them as an example because we keep talking about them, is incredibly convenient. And that doesn't mean that people don't like the music and they don't value it. It's just that they value their time more. So I think to sort of rail against the streaming service is misguided, and I've tried to focus on like it's not the service. Yeah. It is, again, I guess I just take it personally if I can't negotiate with them directly. Like I can have an account with iTunes, and I get the same royalty rate. I get the same rate on iTunes as everybody else does, and I can talk to them directly. But I can't with Spotify, and I can't with like the YouTube, whatever.
So the one other thing that I think that is missing in all this, and particularly as it relates to Spotify and Google, is that, that people aren't taking a step back and going, is ad funding actually an incredibly toxic way of building a society and funding it? Because I don't want anything to do with it. I this is another one of my reasons for not putting things on Spotify or on Google Play, is I don't want to live in a world where people have to be have stuff they don't need pushed on them in order to listen to my music. That's not a triangle I want to be in, where there's me, my listeners, and then crap they don't need over here. And as long as they keep buying that crap, then everything's okay. And I'm like, well, no, I don't want to be a part of that.
That's actually a really good segue. Yeah. The next story was going to be about YouTube. And so, it's been an interesting week. It's been an interesting few months, actually, for YouTube, because, the music service has hit quite a few snags. The latest thing was that YouTube's product manager for music, Chris LaRosa, who played a key part in building the music side of the service, left to join a small startup. Of course, one could wonder whether the issues that YouTube Music has had to launch and the issues contractually have played a part in that exit or not. But it marks the end of a fairly hard few weeks in the sense that, they've had issues around, first they announced the delay, it was in March, I think, or in April, because of product issues, and then the Worldwide Independent Network went public detailing the disappointment in the deals that were being offered by YouTube, and saying that, of course, labels had already signed on because it had very different deals offered to them. And after that, there was a whole controversy about blocking independent artists, independent videos from YouTube if the labels doesn't sign the agreement. And so, Glenn, how do you see this sort of playing out for YouTube? Is it just a little glitch in this huge, massive machine? Or are we seeing a slightly bigger crack forming there as far as the music service is concerned?
You mean crack in terms of just challenges and staff leaving? I mean, as far as staff leaving, people leave for good opportunities all the time. So I wouldn't think that much of that. I mean, look, it's a big fight, and there's a lot to fight over. So it doesn't surprise me that YouTube is having a lot of issues these days. It's often said that YouTube is the new radio. And I think that gets to the heart of it. YouTube has a lot of viewership. And so people are fighting over a precedent that will determine not just the rights and the legal terms that determine, how artists interact with the service and how labels interact with the service, but the financial consequences over the next, 5, 10, 15 years could be huge. So there's a lot to fight over, and it wouldn't surprise me if this is quite protracted because of that.
I think my cat would like to say that he really likes the cat videos, and he likes the ability to get out there. The YouTube is a platform. I get the sense with YouTube that the music thing, was accidental for them. Like they made this, incredible platform, and then it became the number one way that people under the age of 20 consume music. And so I think they're like, oh, this is my guess. Oh my gosh, we should turn this into something. And Google is a really big place, and they might not know a lot of artists. I don't know, because I get the sense, in my little interaction with my account manager there, that often it's the case that the things that I'm concerned about are things that they claim they hadn't thought of. So I don't know. I have no idea what their design process is like, but I'm sort of guessing that this is just like that they didn't think it through or something. That sounds ridiculous for such a huge company.
But at the same time,
I get that sense from other products they have sometimes.
No, it makes sense. No, I think you're completely right. I mean, on the one side, we're thinking of Google as this hugely, superior, all-encompassing and evil sort of monster that has become at least this evil monster because they know everything and they can ask for any terms they like. But at the same time, what's happened in the last few weeks kind of seems to shine a light on a lot of miscommunication internally for them as well. The fact that they announced this blocking without giving details out, and then everybody erupted in that, and then they backtracked saying, oh, we're not going to block and we're not really sure what we're doing here. And
I found them to be very reasonable, in my requests. And so with the contract stuff, I've been talking with them for months since last year about it. And I said what my concerns were, and they said, oh, okay. Oh, we'll get back to you on that one. And, it wasn't like adversarial or anything. So I just think that it's kind of been an organic process, and that said, I don't know if, I don't really understand where it's going to go. I've been trying to imagine what the service would look like, and I'd be a part of it, and I still don't totally know. So,
yeah, we'll see what happens with that one. It's just there's so many variables. Steve, I take it from your stance that you're not on YouTube, or if you are, you're not monetizing content, right?
No. This is the thing. So for me, YouTube, I've never ever thought about how to make money off YouTube.
Right.
I'd like to be able to pay to get rid of the adverts, that both as a viewer and as an artist. I'd love to be able to pay £100 a year and have no one have to look at adverts on my stuff. That'd be great. I don't want to make money off it. I want to get rid of that. For me, YouTube is just about the audience. If it wasn't just if there wasn't the audience there, I'd just stick it all on Vimeo instead.
Yeah.
But there's an awful lot of people I don't make like promotional videos. I put up videos of me mucking about with effects pedals and bits of live stuff and whatnot.
Steve and I are kind of weird. Like, we don't do videos, so we're probably.
we're both really hot, so we should be doing videos.
But there are like, you know, the my fans / listeners, they do use YouTube, so like the thousands and thousands of videos that are up there are all third-party videos, and so I don't stand in the way of that, and I do like the way that I can manage that if I want to by participating in the system, but I don't impede it unless it's some a company who's using music without permission, but individuals and their art projects and what have you, that's fine.
Yeah, that's really cool. for you, like user-generated UGC videos are actually a big thing. You have a lot of people that are using music for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. It's like I have a content manager account. So last check, it was in June, it was like 8,500 user-generated videos, you know.
Wow.
So that's what YouTube is for me, is a way for those listeners to express themselves and make another, you know, use the music in their own projects. And that's a totally different thing than a music service in a way.
Yeah.
I'd have a content manager's account if I had that as well. The thing that I've always really liked about YouTube is I don't know if it was just a side effect of the way that they set this up, is that I can put a cover version up there, and the person who did the original will find out about it because of the way that creepy metadata works on YouTube, and they can then choose to monetize it or have it taken down if they want. Yeah. And all of them, they've chosen to monetize. So I kind of love the fact that Pat Benatar sees me and my wife doing freaky covers of her songs and goes, "Yeah, I'll have some of that." That if she's going to make. She's going to make $100 off that. I'd rather she got it than I got it, because she wrote the song.
It's not $100. I actually turned off the monetization just because, like, it was so not worth it
to interfere
with people's experience. Like, I was like, you know, it's just the money is so little and not.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
I have a couple of friends who make a living out of it. And I think this cuts to the heart of the problem with ad monetization, is that you have to have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of iterations of whatever it is that you're doing for it to get anywhere close to kind of a part-time job flipping burgers kind of money.
Yeah.
So it pushes creatives towards making generic middle of the road stuff that will generate that sort of views. And I clearly don't do that. I have this ridiculous job that's sort of akin to being an erotic balloon modeler. It's like, what do? I play bass on my own. That's never going to generate that. It's never going to do that.
Yeah. Tell me about it. I do podcasts on the music industry, so there you go.
So we do it because we think it's important, not because we think we're going to make out like bandits from ad revenue on it. And so I think finding spaces, because the thing about the conversation about like headline figures of whether sales have dropped or Spotify use has gone up, I'm like, yeah, but how much of that is Nicki Minaj and Katy Perry? Because they don't live in the same world as me. There's that Polish phrase, nie moja małpy, nie moja, not my circus, not my monkeys. And I go, that's not my circus. I don't live in that world. I don't care how many people are listening to Nicki Minaj on Spotify rather than buying her stuff on iTunes.
Yeah.
That's not cannibalizing my listenership.
And I'm conscious that Glenn has to run in about a minute. I just wanted to ask you a last question, Glenn, then we'll let you go and then we'll close the show after you leave, if that's all right. I just wanted to ask you, Vivo, do you think somebody's going to buy it? And if so, how and why?
You know, I don't really have any comment on that. I've seen some names thrown around of companies that might buy Vivo.
Yeah,
I think Apple was one. I think it would be really strange for the company that sells licenses to be acquired by the company that buys licenses. I'm not quite sure how that would work. So there might be some exits available for Vivo investors at some point, but I'm not quite sure what it is. And I do want to go back to something Steve said. I think what Steve says, you know, shows that there's a YouTube can be used for a lot of different things. If you want to monetize, you can. If you don't even want to put official, quote unquote, official videos on there and let your fans do all the work, you can do that. It just means there's a lot of great content that, that I think ultimately helps helps artists. I go to YouTube usually first when I want to learn something about an artist because yeah. it's the best place to look. And it doesn't have to be an official video. It can be anything that lets me get a sense of what that artist is about.
Awesome. Well, Glenn, thanks so much. Again, it's at Billboard Glenn. And if you go to billboard.com and search for Glenn Peoples, you will find all his pieces on there. And thanks so much for your time. And we'll close the show with the guys here. Thank you.
See you, Glenn.
Well, I guess we are probably going to draw the show to a close as well, but I want to, of course, give a bit of a plug to everything that you are doing or that's available online from you. So, Zoe, I guess, do you want to take it away and let people know where they can find sure. your music and what's the best way to essentially get hold of it?
You know, I've decided to release everything sort of in small chunks rather than an album, since I can only work at little bits at the time right now. Yeah. So this summer I'll have out an EP, and you can find that at zoekeating.com. That'll be where it'll be. So
fantastic. Do you have a newsletter as well, yeah. like people can sign up to or something along those lines?
Yeah, I do have a newsletter. I don't write very often, but it's all up there. And, you know, Twitter and Facebook are always a good way to find me.
So. Awesome. That's perfect. And it's at Zoe Cello.
Zoe Cello. Just look for Zoe Cello and I think I'll come up.
Yeah, that's great. And also, on the video, of course, the video version has got your Twitter handle on it as well. But if there's a lot of audio listeners out there, so I just wanted to make sure that they knew about it as well.
Thank you.
And Steve, from your end, well, what's the best way to get to know more about you and get hold of your music?
I'm Solo Bass Steve on most of the internet. So that's three S's in the middle, which is kind of awkward. But Solo Bass Steve on Twitter and stevelawson.net on the web. stevelawson.com will get you a cheap house in Detroit. stevelawson.net will find you.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. He'll hammer out a deal for you or something like that.
And they're very cheap in Detroit, so yeah.
There's a lot of Steve Lawsons online. I keep bumping into them. There's one guy in Denver I really want to meet who's a librarian, and he's much, much cooler than me. He's my favorite online Steve Lawson.
We're Facebook friends.
I'd love to go and hang out because he's just great. He's really, really nice. Look, there's also a Texan preacher I have far less interest in. But stevelawson.net is me, and there's endless and more music than you could ever possibly find useful is there. The Bandcamp link is on the front there, and mailing list and all that stuff.
Perfect.
So, thank you.
That's fantastic. Well, you know, Zoe, thank you so much. I wish you all the best for the next month and excited thank about you. The EP coming out. And Steve, great to have you on for the first time. And I really hope I'll have you both back on again at some point. It was really fun.
Thank you.
And thanks so much for listening to the Digital Music Trends show.
Bye,
you can find everything on digitalmusictrends.com or on youtube.com/digitalmusictrends. Have a fantastic week. And till next time.